Welcome to the first Grassroot Perspective podcast. I'm Malia Hill with the Grassroot Institute of Hawaii, and this is our first effort to bring you a sort of audio edition of our regular opinion perspective analysis piece. Today, we look at our new Senator Brian Schatz, who just jumps right into being a party guy for the Democrats in Washington. We take a look at Ralph Benko's piece in Hawaii Reporter about MoveOn.org meeting with the Tea Party, and a few quick words about the March for Life, which is happening in Washington, D.C. today and in Honolulu tomorrow. At any rate, let's just dive right in, shall we? Hawaii Reporter is telling us that Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz, our new replacement for Senator Inouye, has already jumped right in there with being a good Democratic party line senator and is backing the filibuster reform in the Senate. Now, this is a kind of, let's see how to put this, a sore spot, let's say, because many of you may recall a few years back when the Republicans had control of the Senate, filibuster reform was un-American, a threat to minority opinion, just a darn bad idea in general. Now, Democrats have control of the Senate, and they're using the same talking points that the Republicans did a few years ago. Oh, we need it. We need it to move forward. We're just suffering gridlock and deadlock in the Senate. This is the way forward. Well, it's as bad an idea now as it was then. That's the short version. Filibusters, you may recall back from your days studying this kind of thing, they're the way that the minority in the Senate can block controversial bills and such from coming up for a vote, controversial proposals, by just basically beating them to death with talking, so to speak. There's a majority of 60 votes needed to overcome it, and that's the problem or the point that the majority party is always trying to change. Now, the filibuster reform being proposed right now by Senator Harry Reid is actually, let's call it especially bad, because it sort of unintentionally creates the super senators and significantly special power for the majority leader, in this case, Senator Reid. So it would make it a lot easier for one party to pass legislation, even if half the Senate disagrees, in order to stop debate on a contentious issue. Like I said, right now, 60 votes are required, but the proposal that's being put forward now that Senator Schatz is just fully in favor of would create a way for the majority leader to pass a proposal with only 51 votes. It also creates four super senators who will say critics say they hold the true power. Only four senators would be able to offer amendments to legislation, and that effectively shuts out the other 96. It's another strike at true democracy. It's a strike at the Constitution as it envisioned the Senate. And finally, it creates special power for the majority leader. In it, it gives the majority leader special authority to add an amendment after debate is finished on a particular bill. So essentially, especially when you combine this with that 51 vote threshold, it gives the majority leader the power to just kind of throw through just about anything without the Senate even debating it. And the thing that really kills me about this is how short-sighted it is. Yes, the Democrats have control of the Senate now, but these are, despite what we say when we get frustrated with them, generally speaking, intelligent people who have been around, many of them, for quite a long time. The Senate does not, the Senate may change less than the House, but it still changes hands. The fact that we're talking filibuster reform now from the Democrats, when we were just talking about it from the Republicans a few years ago, just says it all. So the idea that you're going to pass these reforms that give your party these superpowers in the Senate right now, as though that is going to be the situation for years and years or the foreseeable future, it's just ludicrous. Power will change hands, and you will have handed these super special powers over to your political opponents. So it's just incredibly, amazingly short-sighted. To me, it says, we have some stuff that we want to jam through now, and let future senators, you know, even from my own party, take care of themselves. Even if we're, you know, my legacy will be complete, I will be able to make the changes that I want. But to heck with the democratic process, to heck with the Constitution, to heck with founding principles, and, you know, to heck with my party in 30 years. So the short-sightedness of it kills me. The fact that we are basically shutting down debate, shutting down the democratic process is just upsetting. The fact that the Senate, which is already, you know, its own sort of special thing, the six-year terms, even more of a club than the Congress side, is it's just dumbfounding to me. And to just cap it all off, you know, when the Republicans were proposing not the same but various filibuster reforms back in 2005, Senator Reid was a strong defender of the filibuster. You know, he had a quote, let me see here, it goes, he basically said that one of the good things about the institution we have found in the 214 years it has been in existence is that the filibuster, which has been in existence since the beginning, from the days of George Washington, forces people to get together, because sometimes in this body you become very fixed. So somehow, in just a few years, the filibuster has changed from something we need to respect that has been an important part of the Senate since its inception to something we need to get rid of so that somebody, notably the majority party leader, can have super special legislative powers. And of course, getting back to the point, Senator Schatz, barely in Washington, just took over, is jumped right on board. And this points to another issue, you know, Hawaii Democratic politics, you know, say what you will about the Hawaii Democratic Party, but they sure do produce team players. You know, you work your way up, you get your turn at bat, once whoever you needed to resigns or passes away, and then you just walk lockstep in line with the president and the governor and the party's principles. It's really with their policy points. It's really almost amazing. You know, we claim the president as our own because he was born in Hawaii, but you kind of have to wonder, would he have become the president if he had come up through the Hawaii political machine? I don't think so. I don't think he would have gotten the chance. You know, we like our people to just, well, I say we, when probably hardly anyone listening to this is actually would consider themselves one of we in terms of the Democratic Party, but Hawaii does not produce, at least on the Democratic Party side, a lot of independent, bold leaders. You know, we know the Democrats from the other side that go against the grain. We can name them, and we can see what happens to them when they do. They don't get to follow that same trajectory. So without thinking much about it, without deciding to take a stand on principle, without looking at what his own president said, a president who's, he says he's going to support the aims of, said in 2005 on filibuster reform, he's just all in with Harry Reid on it. Disappointing. I kind of feel like maybe he could have spent a couple days reading up, looking at the situation, maybe before jumping in on both feet on deciding that, hey, I've barely been in the Senate, but I totally agree with you on filibuster reform. So, disappointing, but I will confess, not unexpected. Speaking of the president, you know, the inauguration was this week, and a lot has been made of President Obama's inaugural speech, which is, I think, a little interesting, to be honest, because I wouldn't call it unexpected. This is not a president who's hidden his goals. He tells you what he's planning to do, and then he goes and does it. And if you don't believe in bigger government and more spending, higher taxes, expanded involvement in social programs, this is disappointing. But you can't claim that he surprised you with it. Now, I think it says something about the Hawaii, I mean, not the Hawaii, I'm sorry, the the electoral process in general, or the election cycle in America, that somehow a huge portion of people who are involved in voting somehow miss these things when, you know, like I said, it's not hidden. You know, yes, you could say both candidates sort of run towards the center a bit in the national election, but, you know, his record is clear. It always has been. So, you know, the fact that people are combing his inaugural speech and saying, oh, he plans to launch a whole raft of liberal social programs, well, you know, not really a surprise. With that said, he plans to launch a whole raft of liberal programs. Again, not a surprise, but very clearly indicated in this speech. Cato was looking at it and comparing it to, of all things, return to 1965 and Lyndon Johnson announcing the Great Society, which any student of history can tell you is you want to pick the big points in American history when we just walked right into an explosion of spending on social programs. You know, everyone likes to go to FDR and his vision during the Great Depression, but you absolutely cannot understate the importance of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and his war on poverty. A lot of the programs that we continue to try to struggle with how to manage that have just ballooned into government monstrosities in their own right come right out of Johnson's plan. And President Obama has a similar plan. So anyone who was hoping against hope that his plan for the next 4 years was going to somehow involve walking back from the spending nightmare that we're in, you shouldn't really be surprised, but there was no indication at all in that inaugural speech that that's the answer. I mean, the code of it is pretty clear. When someone who of left-leaning liberal politics points out social ills that he thinks are very important, and I think no one will dispute that, you know, these are regrettable social ills, but generally speaking, when a liberal points out social ills, he's not just pointing them out to say, oh, isn't that bad? The unstated part of that sentence is, we're going to do something about it. And if that part's not unstated, the unstated part of that sentence is, by which I mean, we are going to spend money, taxpayer money, government money, on that problem. So we could bet, we can guarantee that we are going to see more spending proposals from the administration in the near future, and I'm sure Senator Schatz will be first in line to give them his A-OK. Going on to a slightly different and unexpected move of the administration, today is the 25th. It's January 25th. It marks the March for Life in Washington, D.C. Tomorrow, the 26th, there'll be a March for Life in Honolulu. I've been to both, actually. And I've got to tell you, if you have to march somewhere in January, definitely do it in Honolulu and not in Washington, D.C. There are a lot of people that go, but it is bitterly, bitterly cold. So anyway, you know, not everyone who listens to this may be pro-life, but I think there are some points of common ground that people who care about liberty can find. And one of the big ones is, you know, taxpayer funding for abortion, and especially funding for abortion abroad. And that's something that kind of gets missed a lot because, well, we get focused very much on what our tax dollars are being spent in our own country. We don't really focus quite as much on the international law part of it, partly because international law is messy and dull, and partly because we just don't get the news and the reporting about it. So it's interesting to note that there was a recent effort by the U.S. State Department to push for reproductive rights basically being defined as a basic human right. Now, if you don't know the code on this, reproductive rights essentially means abortion. So in Rio de Janeiro, meeting at the United Nations, the U.S. delegation was basically trying to enshrine abortion as a basic human right in the U.N. There are rumors that they were planning to push for something called sexual rights, Now, again, international law, these are very vague terms, which is not a good thing. It means that we basically have to guess at what it means in terms of what policies being pushed forward. You know, sexual rights would basically protect the right of children as young as 10 to make their own decisions about sex and reproduction. So important if you think that as a parent, you have some say over what your 10-year-old does in regard to sex and reproduction or what they learn. And that's the fuzziness of these UN efforts. So, you know, in America, we have really unsettled law on UN, the UN, and how our various agreements and treaties with the UN affect things in the states. But we also have, because of federalism, because of the way this all works, because it's just darn hard for the UN to come in and try to tell us how to do things, we have certain protections here, but other countries, you know, not necessarily. So if you care about how we're affecting things abroad, you do care about the fact that we are sort of in a very paternalistic way jumping in to make sure that women in Nicaragua have abortions, have the right to abortion, or 10-year-olds in Nicaragua have a right to make their own decision about sex. Do we even have a place being involved in that? Should we even be spending our taxpayer money being involved in this? And that's before we get into the whole foreign aid issue. So in any case, the effort to make reproductive rights a human right was blocked by a number of UN member nations. That didn't go anywhere, but I think it says a lot about, again, about the administration and their willingness to pursue these policy goals, come hell or high water. You know, they're going to pursue them at home, they're going to pursue them in the UN. You know, following the election, I talked to a lot of people who are concerned about the policy goals that we seem to be headed in right now. The, you know, the taxing, the spending, high taxes, high spending, you know, just even more immersion in these programs that just seem to just put a huge weight on individual liberty and business and the economy with very little of a pro side that anyone can see in the near future. And so there's a lot of, we'll call it blues. There's a post-election blues, and that seemed to come back with the inauguration. And I just want to say there are good signs. You know, it may seem that the opposition to these spending proposals are, and these higher taxes is muddled and confused, and I definitely think it is. We're going through a sort of rebuilding process, a rebuilding year, if you will. But it's necessary. You know, not too long ago, the left went through its own rebuilding year. They came out of it with, let's be honest, a very strong leader and a very strong vision of what they stand for, and they're succeeding. And that's difficult if you don't have the same policy aims. But, you know, I think it's necessary for us to do our own rebuilding, to refocus on what it is that we think it's important. So this is our chance to let, you know, our representatives, our leaders know what's important to us in terms of, you know, lower taxes, a better economic climate, a better climate for business, more friendly business policies, and so on, and just more individual liberty, which gets me to my next point. Interesting bedfellows. Back on Hawaii Reporter, there's an article by Ralph Benko. He's a policy analyst, economic expert, and all-around political activist type. He wrote about a meeting between the head of MoveOn.org and the head of Tea Party Patriots, and how significant that was. And I do think you cannot underrate the significance of a meeting like that. You feel like these are two such different movements, so completely incompatible in their aims. You know, you could use them as polar opposites. But the point that Benko makes, and I think is really worthy of taking here, is that MoveOn.org's co-founder and the Tea Party Patriots co-founder, they have common ground. You know, they may not have a lot of common ground on certain policy principles, but when it comes to naming their enemy, that is the elitist, entrenched political elites, they've got their common ground, and that's what they met over. And if you think about it, there are some points in common here between, Tea parties, the Tea Party and the left's version, you know, the MoveOn.org Occupy types who have a problem with the entrenched political elites, the entrenched political system, and its refusal to listen to this populist part, the populist American voice. You know, it's almost a disregard. So in some ways, you know, these common principles, the importance of listening to the people, of unseating that political elitism, it's a point of optimism. You know, we're not going to, it would be great if we could talk MoveOn.org into being in favor of lower taxes and, you know, helping business, but I'm satisfied that we can talk to MoveOn.org about, well, what about this system that just entrenches political elites, that shuts out the populist voice, that attempts to basically shut them out of taking political power? And here we have a really, really interesting and promising, you know, point of agreement. So strange bedfellows. That's MoveOn.org's co-founder has the Tea Party's co-founder over for Tea by Ralph Benko and Hawaii Reporter. So be sure you check that out. And finally, I want to say a little bit about this up and down thing you may have noticed with Grassroot Institute. You may, if you read our materials, have seen that instead of talking a lot about left and right, Republican and Democrat, conservative and liberal, we say, you know, does this policy move us up to greater liberty, greater personal liberty, or does it move us down to greater government tyranny? And, you know, why do we say this? Why are we so focused on up and down? Doesn't it make it confusing? Actually, on the contrary, we think what's confusing is automatically labeling every policy as a left or a right, a Democratic Republican thing, because it immediately entrenches your opinion on it, especially in Hawaii, where we just have a very entrenched Democratic Party and a really strong base for it. And we're trying to say, hey, look at these things outside of these political definitions. Now, I know I just said a bunch of things and used a lot of left and right, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. And I think those labels do have value when you're talking about, well, when you need to identify a particular party, or when you need to identify which party, you know, that is really the backer of this, or what part of a party is really, you know, pushing for something. But when you want to evaluate a policy on its own merits, that's what we want you to look at it in this up or down metric, because we're really trying to go back to the principles of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and say, let's just cut out that initial partisan reaction and look at what is being asked of us here. What are we being asked to sacrifice? Now, we're not saying that sometimes you don't have to sacrifice individual liberty. We're just saying you need to be aware that that's what's being asked of you. You know, let's not just say, okay, it's Republican, I oppose it. Okay, it's Democrat, I oppose it. Let's look and see what the trade-off is being requested. What is the trade-off being asked? Are we being asked to give up liberty? Why? Is it worth it? You know, because, you know, let's be honest, Hawaii is a strong Democrat state. And we need to look at, you know, so there's a few great minority voices. Senator Sloan especially comes to mind, but there's still such a heavy bias to the one side that we need to look at things in a different way. We need to ask people to look at things in a different way. And we don't want to wade into the whole partisan mess. We want you to look at it outside of partisanship, to evaluate these things on their own merits, and to actually start thinking about policy in terms of what it's asking of us. Now, that's just touching the bare bones of it, but I've been going on long enough for the day, so we'll leave more of that for another time. Anyway, hope you visit us at our website at grassrootinstitute.org. Follow us on Twitter, the Grassroot Institute. Like us on Facebook. I tweet regularly. We're tweeting regularly through the week, so you know it's a good way to keep up with some of the things we've been doing, and a good way to keep up with the upcoming events as well. So be sure to follow us, like us, visit our website, and so on. We'll be back again next week, and I would love to take some questions. We look forward to bringing on some guests over time, so I'll let you know those ahead of time if you have questions for any particular guests. But either email me at maliah@grassrootinstitute.org, or just in the comments, put in your questions for next time, and I will try to get to a few of them, answer or address any questions or comments you guys might have. Thank you. Have a good weekend.